For those of you that joined after the sit started, I just want to welcome you for being here. We don't have any power. We're doing it Buddha style. we just didn't want to cancel. We're just too happy that this opportunity is here. And so it means that we have to actually hold the phone so those of you online could actually hear what we're saying. So it's a little different, but I think it'll work out okay. So just want to give you an idea of what we're going to do. We kind of missed the precepts. So we're going to take the refuges and precepts, and then we will, each of myself and the Ajahns will share some reflections, and then we'll kind of have a dialogue with each other so we can kind of talk to each other. and then we'll open it up for questions for everyone else. And so we're happy you're here. So we'll start with the refuges and precepts.
Bante, Tisadena Saha, Pancha Sailani Hajama, Tutiampi Mayam Bante, Tisadena Saha, Pancha Sailani Hajama, Tatiampi Mayam Bante, Tisadena Saha, Pancha Sailani Hajama.
Hello, everyone. So we'll now do the three refuges and five precepts. And sorry, I have to talk loudly. The Buddha talked about these as streams of merit and also as five great gifts, Mahadana, in that you're giving fearlessness to all beings if you take these precepts. So we'll do the refuges just in Pali, if you just repeat after me, if you want. And then Ajahn Kobilo will do the precepts in Pali and English. And you can either try to stumble through both of those or just go for the English if you want.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa.
Okay, repeat after me.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa.
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 This is going for refuge. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi.
Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi.
Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi.
Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi.
Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi.
Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi.
Dutiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi.
Dutiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi.
Dutiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi.
Dutiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi.
Dutiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi.
Dutiyam pi sangam saranam gacchami.
Tatiyam pi buddham saranam gacchami.
Tatiyam pi buddham saranam gacchami.
Tatiyam pi dhammam saranam gacchami.
Tatiyam pi dhammam saranam gacchami.
Tatiyam pi sangam saranam gacchami.
Tatiyam pi sangam saranam gacchami.
Then I say, ti sarana kamanang niti tang, and you say, sadhu bhante.
Sadhu bhante.
Here's the precepts.
Okay, and we'll do it first in Pali. It just connects us to this long line of practitioners for the last 2,500 years who've been saying the exact same words in probably every continent, maybe excepting Antarctica.
Anatipata Viramani Sikapadang Samadhyami.
Anatipata Viramani Sikapadang Samadhyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature.
I undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature.
Adinadana Viramani Sikapadang Samadhyami.
Adinadana Viramani Sikapadang Samadhyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which has not been given.
I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which has not been given.
Kame sumichachara viramani sikapadang samadhiyami.
Kame sumichachara viramani sikapadang samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct.
I undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct.
Musavada viramani sikapadang samadhiyami.
Musavada viramani sikapadang samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from lying.
I undertake the precept to refrain from lying.
This one's a little bit long, so we'll break it into two parts.
Sura miraya majja pamadatana.
Sura miraya majja pamadatana.
Viramani sikapadang samadhiyami.
Viramani sikapadang samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from consuming intoxicating drink and drugs which lead to carelessness.
I undertake the precept to refrain from taking intoxicating drugs and alcohol which lead to carelessness.
And then I'll just say a beautiful Pali verse about how wonderful it is to have a sense of integrity, and then once you hear me stop chanting, all you can say, sadhu, which just means, yeah, well said, way to go. I agree.
Silena sukating yanti, silena boga sampada, silena nibuting yanti, tasma silang visodaye.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
In the company of many people who have stumbled through that last precept together.
Oh,
it always gets us.
Did you want to start?
Ajahn Kovilo, would you like to start?
Sure.
Let's see. And just maybe a brief introduction, briefly.
Yeah,
I could. So just Ajahn Nisipo, Ajahn Kovilo, this is Twaya Sala, you know her. We're very glad to be here with everyone on Zoom. Seattle Insight has welcomed us since day one, and it's been such a beautiful friendship. We have coffee with Twaya regularly and just talk about Dhamma often, and really feel like Sims or Seattle Insight sort of seeded the ground which we walked into, and I have a lot of gratitude for that. And we've wanted to do a dual teaching for a long time, so this is our first chance. Carrie and Tim did want to be here, but both of them had other commitments which occupied them. But we hope we get other chances in the future. And they've been so gracious and welcoming to us every time we've been with them or had teachers come. And when we were thinking about what to give the retreat on, we thought just this speaking to the relationship which we think we can cultivate between these two communities. Initially, we labeled it upping your game, but then we decided it sounded a lot more inspiring to say mutual awakening. So we switched to that one. And just very grateful to be here and to be welcomed by so much warmth and dharmic kind of care and some new faces, some old faces. Something very appropriate about the electricity all going out at the exact same time. Just an EMP of goodness released right now. And teaching probably in a similar temperature profile to at least some season in the Ganges River Valley. So glad to be here. And for the afternoon, many of you will know, but we'll go till 5 p.m. And initially we had a whole regimen of talks planned out, but then we realized we just really like talking about Dhamma with people and each other. So that seemed a lot more in tune with the spirit of the subject of kind of this mutual reciprocal relationship is just actually having a relationship in the retreat. And it also required a lot less planning. So what we'll do is for about a half an hour or so, Ajahn Kobilo, myself and Tuare will just share some reflections on this relationship between the two communities, the fourfold Parisa assembly of monastics and laity. And then we'll open up to questions and basically just allow everyone to contribute. People can ask and we'll all answer and speak with one another, but just have an open dialogue until about 4:30-ish or 4:40-ish when we'll end with another guided meditation together. So, is that sound about right, Tuare?
That's right.
Okay.
Well, start just sharing a bit of my own reflections on the relationship between the monastic Sangha and all of the lay people. And Ajahn Nisibo and I, we arrived a little bit early thinking we might be able to help with setup. And we got here and Sean was here and Cheryl was here and everything was basically already set up. So we didn't have to do anything. And basically my thought other than just meet and say hello to a few people who came early as well. And I just kept looking up on what is kind of like a stage. You know, we are maybe 8 inches, 10 inches off of the ground that you're all sitting on. And just kept looking up and like, how are we going to sit? How are we going to sit? What is the right way to sit? Is Tuare here? And I'm here. And Ajahn Nisibo, is Tuare in the middle? And I just went through, there aren't that many combinations, possibilities for where each of us could sit. And I think I went through every single one of them. And I was just like, actually, they all work. They all work perfectly. And part of me thought that if we had like the two ochre columns on the outside, you didn't know what you were going to be wearing, but ochre columns, they would just go with anything. So figure wherever we're sitting, it's going to work. And it just did kind of get me thinking about the shape, like the physical shape of this relationship between the Sangha and the laity, and a little bit of the architecture of, this high and low of the Sangha, or the high and low of teaching Dhamma. And it's fascinating. Is it a triangle? Is it two parts monastic Sangha, one part lay Sangha? I mean, just population-wise, it's nowhere is it like that. It's always the extreme minority of just humans who are going to think, oh, it would be a great idea to shave off our heads and put on these robes and take on all these rules. And we have tons of rules. We have so many rules. And we kind of like it like that. There's some percentage. I think in Thailand, there are 300,000 monks and a population of about 70 million. So that's like less than 0.5% of the population that is monastic. And that's probably similar in other Buddhist countries and much less, of course, in America. So it's not a triangle. And
come into this room and two monastics and however many lay people are to whatever shape that is. But I thought a good shape for this relationship is a circle. And it's kind of symbolized by one part that makes us monastics, which is the alms round. So one part of being mendicants, literally we're bhikkhu. That's a Pali word, and it means literally those who beg, those who go around, walk around. We don't have money. We don't use money. We don't have a penny to our name. If we touch a penny, if we touch a physical dollar, then we have to confess it with another monk, and then we have to appoint another monk who will take that dollar, throw it behind their back, and say, don't care where it goes. So we literally don't have money, and we're dependent for every calorie that we eat. Every calorie that Ajahn Nisbo and I have eaten in the last 15 years has been a gift to us. So in Buddhist countries, and now that Buddhism is coming to America, we go on this alms round. We leave our huts. We live largely secluded for most of the day, 23, 22 hours of the day. We're living in huts by ourselves. That's the root of the English word monk or mano, monastic, those who live by themselves. So we're living by ourselves. We're celibate, and we practice. We practice all of our rules. We practice meditation, practice learning how to be alone in a room by ourselves and not depressed. So, and you may all have realized that that is not an easy thing to do. So we leave our huts and we come and practice being in community. We walk with our alms bowls and we walk the city. We walk to Pike Place and people will come and meet us there. We do have a website. People can join in, see when are the monks coming and how can I meet them. You can bring food. It's a great relationship. We come and we receive food. And here in America, we actually have a conversation. We have a Dhamma conversation. Whoever comes, we talk Dhamma. And it's oftentimes a highlight both for the people who come, talk about how their week in Dhamma has been, and for us as well to be able to connect and expand our minds, hear about the lives that people live, which are almost invariably more complicated than our intentionally very simple, explicitly renunciate lives. And then we receive our food and we chant a blessing in Pali. And then we go back to where we live, we go back to our huts and continue practicing, just eating that one meal a day. So it's a round and it's a relationship. The Buddha didn't allow, we can't keep food afternoon. We can't plant food. We can't plant crops. So we're intentionally dependent on the lay people. There's this reciprocal relationship. And that's good because, yeah, in other Buddhist countries, when they got rid of this rule where monastics have to be dependent, where monks and nuns could plant crops, they could then build walls and have communes and compounds where we just make all our food and meditate as much as we want and don't have to be at all accountable to the lay people. Whereas here, you see us, you interact with us. You meet us if you want on a daily basis, and you can get a sense of how pure or corrupt somebody is by just how they manifest to you on alms round. We're accountable and you get a flavor for that. We come out and give teachings and it's beautiful. And any monastic who is not a psychopath, any monastic who just has some kind of sense of integrity and wants to have a sense of integrity, wants to have a keen moral conscience. This is something you can train. And it's something the Buddha said, the Buddha called it a power, the power of conscience. And this is something we're training in. And when you have that and you want to have that, then you want to be a good monk. You want to be a good nun. You want to practice well, to be worthy of the food. What are we doing? The people who give us food every morning, you're not paying for anything. It's not a typical transactional relationship. You give us food and don't ask for anything. In Thailand, monks don't even give a blessing in Pali. And there's not even a conversation, really. It's just people come out, put food, sticky rice in the monastic's bowl, and then the monks keep walking. So it's not transactional. But we have to reflect on that. Are we living up to our side of the bargain? Are we cultivating wholesome mental states? And similarly, if we are, what our robes represent is part of this architecture, why it makes sense to have some kind of raised platform, whether it's here in a lay Dhamma center or in a monastery. is because we're representing the height of that, the length of a monastery, the length of a church indicates this kind of separation. It is part of a Theravada right view that there is this world, there is the next world, i.e. there is samsara and there is nibbana. And there are samanas and brahmins, there are renunciates who practice this path and have realized the fruit, have realized the goal. And this is a categorical different. There are people, definitely not all monastics, not all monks and nuns. In fact, probably almost certainly the majority of monastics, monks and nuns, have not attained awakening. But we're trying, and that's what this is a symbol of. And this is a belief until you've realized that there can be a categorical sea change in our consciousness, in the way the mind works. There are these levels of awakening that these ochre color represents, that it is possible to not just temporarily abandon greed and anger, but an arahant, someone who's completely awakened, has done just that. They've completely transcended greed, anger, and delusion. And they won't transgress. It's not just a temporary thing. And this is a belief. And you have to come down wherever you are. If you've never met anybody like that, or you hear that and you're just like, oh, that's a fairy tale that monks tell in order to get food, or you know, whatever it is. But you can choose to believe that. And I've met, Ajahn Nisibo has met, and hopefully maybe some of you have met people that you do believe this seems like a different kind of person. And when you come to a monastery, you live very close to teachers. You can, if you go to good monasteries, people who do seem different. They've been practicing for decades and trying to purify the heart. When angry mind states come up, they don't act on them. And more, it's like when we first give up cigarettes or when we first stop drinking, it's hard for a while. But then after some time, it's like, I don't even want a cigarette anymore. And you take that and extrapolate that principle. When we first stop speaking from a overtly angry mind, or even before then, when we stop physical violence, after some time, we don't even think about hitting another human. Next level, speech. Angry thoughts come up, but we, for a time, it's hard to not speak from that anger. But angry mind states still come up. But just extrapolate, take that principle out. Is it possible that after a period of time, after seeing more and more quickly, being more and more mindful, okay, here's an angry thought, I don't want it, let go. First, it takes 24 hours, then maybe after years, it takes 12 hours, another decade, it takes half an hour, another decade, maybe it takes 5 minutes, and maybe after 5 or 6 decades, and hopefully you're all faster than that. But yeah, at some point, maybe those angry mind states, those mind states of craving and addiction just never come up. So that's what these are symbols for. And most monastics will fall far, far short of that. But we wear these robes all the time. We don't own pants. We don't own, really, we don't even own any other colors. So it's not like we do this when we're coming for alms and then we go back and it's party time at the monastery, or we don't go out to the bar. We don't go out to the club. I don't even know how to dance anymore. I used to be a good dancer, but we don't. We keep our rules all the time. And it's good to remember that and to be able to come back and try to represent something that's greater than ourselves. And it's humbling to meet teachers and to meet lay people who honestly have been practicing the path longer than us. Lay people who have been meditating longer than us, who are more generous than us, who are more virtuous in some ways than us. And to try to live up to this, like the bowing that happens in a monastery. Again, if you're not psychopathic, you have to figure out a way to relate to that, to people bowing to you. And you realize it's not at all me. It's totally to the road, to this principle that it is possible to free the mind, to transcend greed, anger, and delusion. And when we see that, it's a reminder. It's like, okay, I really do have to live up to this. I have to, you know, sit upright a little bit more. I can't be slouching. You have to accept the bow with the spirit with which it's offered. So we wouldn't be monks except in relationship to laity and to really take this relationship seriously, the roles that each of us play seriously, and to try to live up to the highest of each of those roles. So thank you all very much, Tuareg. Thanks so much for inviting us.
Thank you.
Really
thank
great you. To be able to sit thank here with you. And, yeah. So either one of you can.
I can add a few different images. First, can the people from Zoom hear us okay? Is it too choppy?
Tamara, can you hear us?
Okay.
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up. Thumbs up. Great. We can turn off the video if the connection gets bad. So that was a beautiful talk by Ajahn Kovilo. And whenever he mentioned dancing, we once had a debate about which one of us would win a dance off if we ever could dance. I think we decided he would win, but
he wins at singing.
If we
could medley.
And I also thought, in terms of this reciprocal feedback loop of generosity, someone about a year ago gave us a fan. And we were like, who do we gift this to? Like, no one uses fans anymore. And now I'm so grateful that someone has a fan because I understand now why they are so useful. And very impressed. So, so I had a brother monk named Adrian, who I went on Tudong with. And some of you will know what Tudong is. It's where we wander on faith. We walk on faith. We go out and we don't take money. And as Ajahn Kovilo mentioned, we depend on others for everything, for food. We can't ask for food. When we go for alms, we don't even, we're careful not to open the lids of our bowls, actually, so it doesn't look too much like begging. We kind of just stand there looking like we look and people come and talk to us. And I was in Australia, and before we went on Tudong, this monk came to me and he said, I had this dream, and I dreamt that I was jumping off of the top story of a building and skydiving, and I opened the parachute and I landed softly, and then I jumped from two stories down and opened the parachute, and it opened just in time, and I landed kind of hard on the ground. And then I jumped from one story down from that, and the parachute didn't have time to open, and I woke up. And he said, I think sometimes the bigger jump is the safest. Sometimes the bigger jump is the safest. And I think of this with what we are doing as monks and as a growing Buddhist community and society in the West. The rules the Buddha gave us are, on the surface, just completely impractical. We can't ask for things. We're completely helpless. We can't drive. We can't store food. We can't use money. And when Ajahn Kovilo mentioned that, I remembered my dad was visiting a Bayagiri monastery where Ajahn Kovilo ordained, and I spent quite a while in California. And my dad learned that the fastest way to bring a monastery to a screeching halt is to leave a couple of quarters in the dryer. So, none of the monks could do any laundry. And it's always this debate, you know, you hear, okay, Buddhism has adjusted to every society it's gone into, and that's what's let it survive. And it's a justification that's used often to kind of bend things a little bit. And the Buddha did say that we want to speak the vernacular of the land you're in. And that was an astounding insight in a religious landscape where the Brahminical tradition had insisted that all teachings be carried in Sanskrit. The Buddha said, look, teach in a way people can understand. And we do that here. You know, Tuareg speaks in terms of references and language people can understand, can intuit. And yet the core of the teaching, what's being transmitted, is it's the same. It's this kind of kernel of what the Buddha gave us. And there's an amazing article called The Lineage of the Noble Ones by Thanissara Bhikkhu, where he says that, you know, actually what's happened is when a really strong contingent of
monastics and Sangha move into a new culture, they change the culture around them. It's not the other way around. And it sounds grandiose, and perhaps, you know, an entire culture doesn't always shift. But what we've found is when you begin to compromise, there's a trust fall involved with stepping into this landscape of what the Buddha really gave us. You know, when I came to Seattle, we put our name down on, we went to Pike Place, and no one had signed up to give the meal. And within half an hour, seven people had offered food. It helps initially people think our bowl is a drum, but then when someone gives a baguette, it kind of sticks out and people understand what it is, and that helps. Seven people, and in 4 years, we haven't gone hungry once. And it's crazy. Who would think that would work, you know? And yet, the image of a Buddhist society, which the Buddha laid down, which is based on this reciprocal relationship between the laity and the Sangha, it's archetypal in nature. It's somehow transcends every worldly metric we would want to put on it in terms of what is valid or possible or practical. And yet, the deeper you surrender into that, the more you realize there's something there that is beyond the usual worldly metrics of relationship and transaction. And you step into a field where everything dissolves, the boundary between giver and receiver. You know, Ajahn Kovilo talked about this experience of being bowed to, which happens in a monastery. And the Buddha said that a gift given to the Sangha was of greater benefit than even a gift given to him, the Buddha himself. Which for me is his way of saying that this container of the robes and of the teaching as a whole is the most precious thing. And it's predicated on a relationship between the monastic Sangha and the laity. And when you're in that relationship, you realize the giver and the receiver, and who's bowing or where you're sitting, it all just dissolves into something that feels transcendent, and you're all kind of existing in service to the Dhamma. And that's really what it feels like when you step into that realm of relationship. The Buddha said that one thing you begin to see as you let this relationship grow is this mutual giving really bears amazing fruit. And I've heard someone recently say that all healing occurs in relationship. And that's a really important thing to take into sort of metabolize, because I think, you know, the first pioneers of Buddhism in the West were lay groups, and thank goodness they were the initial bridges. But it's hard to exist as a self-contained entity. And the key relationship where healing and growth and spiritual sanctity occurs is a relationship between the Sangha and the lay community. And just seeing how that happens and how this relationship of mutual giving, of generosity, of surrender, of trust can manifest when you have those two nodes extant and existing, it's really profound. And often this is what I see as the great missing puzzle piece in a lot of people's Dharma lives right now is a monastery nearby. And I think it's why the relationship between Sims and Clear Mountain could be so poignant and potent, because we have a lay group which has deep care and respect for the Dhamma and for the teachings and the lineage. And we have monastics, and now we have the Kunis also in the area. And if we allow that relationship to grow, then you really, one thing that we help carry as monastics come from Thailand is a lineage which speaks to these other ways of relating to the teaching in a very robust manner. There's a whole mythology and ritual and color and daily ethos of giving, which you see in Thailand and in Buddhist countries, which lets a Buddhist practice become a Buddhist life.
And that's a really key motion, because many of us have intuited how much we would like to give our lives to this practice. But if all you have is that half an hour of meditation a day, it's hard to channel all of the heart's waters into that one stream bed. And as soon as you have a relationship to give it into and a physical location, and, you know, Seattle Insight has created this beautiful space, but the more we can get that, the more and wider we can create kind of relationship we can create through the lay monastic relationship, the better. And you just begin to see how there's enough room there for a whole Buddhist life to manifest and for a practice to really flourish and blossom. And I think that is the relationship that I hope we can kind of cultivate here. And it's very interesting to navigate. There's a lot of instances in the suttas where the monastics are misbehaving, and the lay people will come to the Buddha and say, those sons of Sakyans, how can they possibly blank or blank? And the Buddha will lay down a rule. And there's other talks or suttas where different lay people, Chitta the householder, Uga, teach monastics. And it's not that the lay people provide requisites of food and so on, and the monastics provide dhamma. This interchange is relational and dharmic, and we are learning from each other with how we can create a Buddhist culture in the West that honors those deepest strata of teachings and doesn't compromise the essential core there, but also honors the deep wisdom that the West has brought, and teachings of inclusivity and care and relationality. And what's so surprising is that as the Sangha comes, the Theravada kind of conceives of itself as the school of the elders, but it really has also accumulated a great deal of cultural accretion. And as it's had to adjust to these insights from the West about equality and all these other institutions, the revival of the Bhikkhuni Sangha, what we find again and again is actually we're just getting closer and closer to what the Buddha taught in the first years of his, during his lifetime. The Buddha created an order for women. He had such compassion for that realm of society, which would so put aside. There's a special rule in the Bhikkhuni order that usually a Bhikkhuni will have to wait until they're 20 years old to ordain. But if they're married young, then there's a special exception where they can ordain at 12 years old, to like this escape clause for an unwholesome marriage. And again, you see that what we're doing as we modernize the teaching, we're just getting closer to what the Buddha said. And we have to be careful not to take that too far, because, we really have to be checking things against what the original teachings were. But I think that as what we find and can find together is like there will be this mutual growth and understanding. And it's a real honor to be part of that relationship and growth. So. Mm-hmm. Please.
Wow. I'm going to speak a little bit about the lay side. It really is, I believe, it has a lot to do with what Ajahn Nisibo said, that this relationship in the West is very different than the relationship between monastic and laity in the East. It's very different. And it goes to that thing that Dhamma comes into a community and speaks within that community the way it is. I mean, many of us lay practitioners have this deep-seated love for the Dhamma, but we don't want to be monastics. And there isn't that necessary call for us to go into this monastic life or this homeless life, and yet we devote our lives to the Dhamma. We devote our vacation time to going on retreat. We don't go just go play. We devote our daily lives to practicing and coming in the evenings to talks. And if you know practitioners, a lot of their lives is dedicated around Dhamma in some way, some Sangha, some center, something that we get involved with. And I can remember being in the early years of Seattle Insight, all I ever really did on the weekends would be go to some weekend non-residential that Sims was putting on, 70 a year. And then every, at the end of every beginning class, there would be this day long. So a lot of my extended practice was partly because I spent so much time coming to the center and coming to events around Dhamma. My life was centered around Dhamma. So on one hand, you might think, well, that's not really a holy life. It's not monastic. But there's something unique in this culture that this is what we do. So we try to have our working life. We find ways, even as we go to work every day or go to work on this different jobs. I was a trial lawyer and I still fit the Dhamma into my normal work. And, you know, there's Christianity. I mean, I was raised Christian. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, that's here. And that practice, it is incorporated into our society. So maybe it's not so much for Islam because it would be hard to do the five prayers. You really do have to make a way for you to do your five prayers. But basically, Christianity and Judaism is part and parcel of the life we live in this country. But as a Buddhist, it didn't feel like my practice, my life, spiritual practice, could fit into my ordinary life as a trial lawyer. And even with that, I still persevered. I still found ways to bring my practice into both the courtroom, my job, it didn't matter. And it is because while this is spiritual practice, there is, you know, monastics take up the holy life. They take up this life of homelessness. And it's a whole ritual around the robes and what the rules and everything. And I don't take up that kind of a holy life. And yet, I believe many of us as lay practitioners would consider ourselves urban contemplatives. We live in an urban environment, true enough. But our lives center around this holy life, this life of the Dhamma, and living out of the life of the Dhamma. So the Eightfold Path is not necessarily something we just study. We also take up this contemplative life to live out the Eightfold Path in the way that we live. And I think this comes from the way the Buddha related to laity, even when he was walking around. There are many, many, many suttas where lay people would come to the Buddha and, you know, one that I love, you know, he came, he says that, you know, this renunciant life, that's where the whole mass of the people drop off. That's where we stop. You guys keep jumping over the edge, but we're like stopping right here. We don't want to do that. And it you could see where the Buddha could look at this person and look down upon them for just saying, we don't want to do that. But the Buddha admitted he had problems with renunciation at first also. So he's like relating to this person just as they are and not creating this hierarchy that he could have created. There's another sutta where someone says, well, what do we do as lay people? We like, you know, laying in the bed with lots of kids and eating food. And, you know, that we like sex. We like money. We like stuff. And so what do we do? And again, he did not have this diminished value over people being able to say that. So it speaks to something that the Buddha would talk to lay people in the same kind of honorable way that he would talk to his monastics, his nuns and monks. He would have this honorable way and not putting overburdened energy on us, like you guys are going the wrong way. He would just speak to what are the difficulties the laity has and how do we work through our difficulties. And I think that is why when these, our teachers of this lineage, when they brought this practice to insight, this insight, Vipassana practice to the West, because they didn't bring Buddhism to the West for sure. Buddhism's been here as long as there's been people here. So it's not that. They brought a particular type of practice to the West. And that particular practice is what enables us to be urban contemplatives. It's the, what enables us to go on retreat and practice into the depths of meditation and see the wisdom, like open our Dhamma eye so that we can see the Dhamma and see the Buddha in a way that really just, I guess it cultivates our spirituality. You know, it cultivates our ability to find something meaningful in the world other than just following the edicts that someone might hand down. And so we get to find for ourselves this liberation that we see in the robes. And we may not be in the robes, but we get to find for ourselves in our own way. There's a sutta. I'm just going to say this one little piece here. There's a sutta that I fell in love with on retreat. This monastic told me about Venerable Pukkasati. I love him very much. And he was this regular person who took up the holy life as Venerable Gotama, Buddha, his monastic name. Gotama, he took up this holy life and to follow Buddha. And he heard that Buddha was going to be at this place, so he goes to get to that place, to go see a teacher that he has fallen in love with, though he has never seen this teacher. And so he stops off at this barn on the way, and Buddha happens to be traveling towards that place. He isn't really there yet. And he stops off at the same barn. And so the two of them spend the night in this barn, and they meditate. And the sutta says that the Buddha was impressed with Venerable Pukkasati's, you know, diligence and earnestness. But he could see that there were some gaps. He probably was sitting there thinking like the rest of us. And he could see that Pukkasati wasn't actually in the practice. And so he wanted to help him out of compassion, help him stabilize his mind, help him stabilize his practice. And so he asked Venerable Pukkasati, "Who's your teacher?" He says, "Venerable Gotama, that's my teacher. The Buddha." He's like, "Have you ever seen the Buddha? Have you ever seen it?" Like, "No." "Would he know who you are?" Like, "No, I'm going to see him. You know, I'm going to see him. I know where he's at. I'm going to go see him." And so the Buddha begins to help him by telling him how to practice. What it is that we do following the Satipatthana. What we do as lay practitioners when we come and we sit and we practice and we practice and we practice and we practice. Just that sitting. We don't have the robes, but we have the container of practice. When we come to Sangha, when we sit with each other, we talk to each other, we have this container. We begin to follow it. And the Buddha began to go basically through the Satipatthana with Venerable Pukkasati and tell him all these ways that he could, through the Satipatthana, begin to find his way and steady his mind. And the more the Buddha talked to him, the more the Buddha began to look like this guy, began to look like the Buddha. The more he began to see, and then he had this realization, oh my God, I'm sitting in front of my teacher right here, talking to him. And that clarity comes from the practice. What I think the monastic order brings for lay practitioners, like for us in the West, is validity. It brings authority. It brings a sense of righteousness as to what we're doing. So even though we don't have the robes in, we all learn from monastics. We stay close to monastics. A lot of our teachers are monastics. A lot of the wisdom that we get, we constantly look back at the suttas and begin to tie and weave this monastic understanding together. And it adds stability to our practice. And it helps us see the Buddha, see the Dhamma, just like the Buddha did for Venerable Pukkasati. So, yeah, those are my thoughts. That's what I think. I think you guys help us see. Thank you. So we can just take a little time, you know. I think I'll start. Ask you guys the question. You can ask me some questions, but you know, it's one thing to be in a country like in an Asian country or go to Thailand, monks all over the place, nuns all over the place walking around, and people see that. What is it like when you just like you came here and you walked from the ferry all the way here? How do you, or maybe you got a ride, but it, you know, you do.
You got a ride.
You just walk a lot. I've walked with you, so we do walk around a lot. And people, you know, it's not that normal to see, especially white males as monastics, not that normal. So how does it feel to kind of walk around regular people?
I think ever since the Catholic Reformation, which needed to happen for a few reasons. I mean, there was things to reform in the Catholic Church, but I think that the West lost a lot of its monastics then. And it's things ever since then, it's been kind of scrambling to make up for that gap. And you see this sort of fruitless movement in a lot of the culture of trying to rediscover that archetype. And we project it onto our artists and our writers, but Bukowski is a terrible role model, you know. He's a total jerk. And even, you know, someone like Tolstoy, who, you know, had some spiritual depth, but he was quite unhappy in a lot of senses. And so I think there's something about the monastic form, which is archetypal in the heart and which people recognize in a way you would not expect, even in the West. So it's very interesting coming here. And, you know, I mean, at first you do feel a bit awkward stepping into a, you know, your first few years in robes, but it feels so natural now in the sense, like, I think in 4 years in Seattle, I've only gotten maybe one negative comment from someone kind of a stable mind. And they just said, come on, man, as they jog past. And that 4 years, yeah. That's it. And see, it's astounding how I think people do recognize that archetype and want to talk about the spiritual life with someone. And I'm sure many of you occupy this role in the lives of friends, of, you know, your friends, where you're the person they know they can actually speak to about this stuff. But, you know, we dress the part. And so, I find it's actually surprisingly comfortable. And people you would not expect will come up to you and want to talk about their spiritual life or be very open to that side of things.
Do you have a
low battery?
Do you have a plug?
I don't. I think it's Cheryl's, actually.
Yeah, it's a pretty high battery.
Okay. We could zoom in another.
Get another phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have my.
I've got one as well. That could be great.
Okay, great. Said. Thank you.
What about you, Ojo?
Yeah, I mean, maybe just a little case study is the place that Ajahn Nisbo mentioned that I ordained in California. It's like a perfect little Buddhist bubble, actually. Like in America, you know, it's anywhere between 10 and 20 monastics. We're all dressed like us. And then people intentionally leave the rest of America to come into this little Buddhist bubble. And there we only went alms round once a week. So pretty much, and for the first 5 to 7 years that you're a monastic, you do take this vow of stability and you stay with your teacher until, or if you need to go anywhere, you want to go anywhere, you kind of ask for permission. So we're basically in the Buddhist bubble full time, all the time. And that's what we're living in. That's the ocean for us. We're little tiny fish just learning how to swim in this perfect little unique aquarium. But then you leave, you go for alms, and it is a little bit strange. Like people offer us marijuana and on alms round, and we have to say no. And but it was fascinating. So my parents, their interaction with Buddhism through me and through the monastery and then through Thailand was a fascinating, just one little story. But yeah, so white American guy growing up, like, you know, Unitarian, not really having any kind of religion in America. And yeah, then coming to meditate, and then I do a 10-day meditation retreat. And it totally changes my life, but I'd still never step foot in a monastery. I don't know what it's like to be a monk. So I just have this pretend idea, this cartoon picture of what a monk should be doing with their life. And I'm trying to live that out. And I'm getting stranger and stranger, getting weirder and weirder. And everybody can tell except me, especially my family. Yeah. Yeah, totally. And then family thinks weirder and weirder. And then I go to the monastery, and actually the abbot and all the other monks there, they're mirrors as well. And they can tell, okay, this guy, he wants to be, he's like really sincere, but he's weird. Something is off. So it takes, there's like years of kind of, you know, inching us in, you know, a kind of safe and balanced direction. And my parents were so happy when they actually came to this little Buddhist bubble aquarium, met our teacher, Ajahn Pasano, who's just, you know, from way up north in Canada, but has been a monk for 50, 40 years and lives the part, doesn't live a cartoon of the part. They meet him, they meet it. Okay, this is a safe community. And then I go to Thailand and they visit me in Thailand and they walk alms around with us and they just see what an integral part of the society a monastic serves, what an integral part a monastery serves. People come to the monastery once a week, though, you know, large portion of the village come to the monastery at least once a week. And they see that and they're like, okay, we were starting to feel good with him when he was in this little aquarium. Okay. It's not entirely a cult, but it's still a little bit culty. But then they go to a Buddhist country and see that. And yeah, just see there is a place for this role. We're not just making it up. And that was good for them to see. And it was good for me to be able to see them interact with me in that sense. So yeah, just one little story, but yeah. Curious about you, Tori. Can we flip the questions out? Yeah. So what?
And then open stuff up.
Open things up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what has been your relationship? I assume as well, you didn't grow up seeing monks and nuns, but how did your relationship with that form of the Sangha, Buddhist monastics or Christian monastics, but maybe especially Buddhist monastics, how did that evolve? Was it strange at first?
It was.
And how did it evolve? And what is it like now?
It was very strange. I was raised a conservative Black Christian. And so I was very strong Christian influence. And yet when I was a kid, my imaginary friends that I had were Buddhist. I didn't even know anything about Buddhists, but I somehow had them. One was like a monk, and so they were the friends that I would walk around with without really grasping what it is that I was doing. And then by the time I got to be in my, I think it was my junior high years or going in, is when the TV show Kung Fu came on. And when that show came on, that was it. That was it. That's who I'm going to be, just like him. And I would try to walk around on paper without leaving a print, because I thought you should be able to do that. That's how you would know you were Buddhist, if you could walk on paper and not leave a print. But, you know, it never happened. But I do remember getting more and more and more difficult in terms of how I believed around my family. Like the idea of doing no harm seemed very important to me. Just my views on life and views on the way we should live was very different than a lot of my family. And so as I was growing up and going into my 20s, and so it was very awkward with my family and me. It was finally when I actually started practicing was in my mid-30s. And in my mid-30s, you know, all I knew was altar calls. I don't know if you guys have been in Christian churches, but all I knew was altar calls, which meant that at some point in the church, the pastor would come down and open the doors of the church, and anybody that wanted to be a Christian would come forth and give their life to God. And that's what I knew. So I created my own altar call to come to Buddhism. I was going to come to Buddha and give my life to Buddha. And that was it. That was my sort of private, in a closet, me doing something that I was too afraid to even tell my family that I was doing. And yet it felt like I had to. And so there was this calling, is what I'm saying, about this contemplative. Many, many, many lay practitioners are the only ones in their family or friends that practice. And yet they stay with it in this calling, even though everybody else around them is not really practicing this way at all. And so I had to learn, because I didn't have the rope so much, I had to learn how to keep my practice sacred with me. So this container for me, and not have it subject to the judgments of everybody around me. That was probably the hardest. I think that's the same thing you're saying about when you found your teacher and you learned that balance between being yourself and being in this monastic world. I think we as laity have to learn how to balance this altruistic relationship we have with the Dhamma and going to work or doing going to the family thing, and everybody's drinking and going crazy, and you got to sit there and be like, oh, okay, well, that's what we're doing, but I'm not going to drink. And you have at it, you know, this kind of balancing our practice with the world we live in such a way we have to learn how to not diminish the people around us in their way. And so, yeah, I think if we were to open it up, pretty much people would say, yeah, we all kind of went through that, kind of people looking at us like, what's wrong with you? Why are you acting that way? And yet, when I came to Seattle Insight, that's when I knew I was home. I mean, I'll just share this one little story. I figured I practiced 10 years by myself before I came to Seattle Insight. And I thought I was pretty much on my way to enlightenment. Any minute now, I figured it was coming. And I was a long way. So a friend of mine wanted to do Seattle Insight. She wanted to take Rodney's beginner's class, and she had heard about him. And I'm not a beginner. I'm like senior. I should be at the senior level. But she begged me to come because she would be too afraid to be a beginner. And so I agreed, okay.
And hundreds of dollars a ticket on a $100,000 Stradivarius. And they dressed him in normal clothes and jeans and put him in a subway just to busk and see what would happen. And there's a video of it, and you just see everyone passing by him, and he's just playing. And the only people that try to stop are the children, you know, and the parents sort of drag them on. And, you know, initially you think that he's a ghost, and then you realize that he's the only real one and everyone else is the ghost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just feel like there's a sutta where the Buddha says that what the world considers false, the noble ones consider true. And what the world considers happiness, the noble ones consider suffering.
Yeah.
And just that moment of recognizing that note, and yeah, just everyone thinking you're just very strange, and then coming into communion with people who do get it, and that sense of, I think that really is the power of the community.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. It feels like coming home. So we probably should spend some time opening it up and seeing what you guys think and maybe share some of your comments. Maybe not so much questions. If you have a question, that's great, but it would be nice to just share some comments enough so we can get a sense of people, and even online. Yeah, go ahead. So we're going to have to repeat it because people won't be able to hear it otherwise.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thanks. Because I'm usually on Zoom, and a lot of times I can't hear the questions. You want me to bring the phone to people as they're talking?
No, because we don't have a power.
Oh.
Yeah.
I am wondering if the Ajahns would say a little more for people who aren't familiar with what exactly you're trying to accomplish with the monastery. And also, as a layperson who wants to do whatever I can to support you, I know there's so many rules. Like, you can't ask for what you need. And so if somebody says, just let me know what I can do to help you, you can't really do that. And at least I don't think you can. But there's a lot of rules around food. You don't eat afternoon, but you're at Pickless Mount Market in the morning. I learned through experience that if I give you fruit, somebody has to slice it first. the seed can't come to life, and lots of things like that. So what I want to know is someone who just wants to do a little more than I'm doing now. You put in your first offer for some land on Cougar Mountain, and it's not an expensive land, so there's that. And you have people who are helping handle financial situations with you. If you feel comfortable, I'd love to have you talk about that and talk about how we can help with that. And also, if there's any rules we need to do or what is most helpful for you when we do bring food to Pike Place. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Julie. So the question, I'm going to summarize here, was, it's a really good question, just Julie was noting we have a lot of rules, but we also have a vision. And how, if people want to support that vision or make sure we don't starve, how can they help? Is that the gist of it? So with regards to food, first, there is something called pavarana, which is invitation. And if someone invites us and says, if you need anything, let me know, then we can actually let you know. So I don't know if you actually meant that, but there you go. Now we can approach you. Thank you. Okay. Appreciate that. If you know of 40 acres for free on Cougar Mountain, let us know. That would be really great.
<That's right.
laughs> Okay, good. So that invitation is beautiful. And if people come for alms, on the website, there's an alms calendar, and people can come and just bring food, and you can always ask what would be helpful at the time, and we usually say protein and vegetarian is helpful. And as to the project, it's true that we're looking for land and have put in an offer. The end result of the vision is we want a monastery close enough to the city center that people can come after work and actually come and meditate together or on days off, come and spend time in the hall garden. We would like a columbarium there for the dead, so ashes. And just this is a huge lack in our culture, is a place to put the dead and remember them. And it's like you've been listening to treble your whole life and suddenly you hear bass and you realize what you've been missing in our culture. And that's remembering the dead, I think. So we want that. And that's the vision. And then for the monastics, we want a place for monastics 5 years and up to come and train and stay for the moment. And then eventually, hopefully more and more. But, you know, one can find details on that on friendsofclearmountain.org. But honestly, I feel whatever crests of the waves manifest in land getting an offer or this or that, they're resting on much deeper and mysterious currents. And if people can just practice well, honestly, like that's the great, you know, we've been to places and they say, given such a way, you don't feel regret. But that implies that you're in the red. And it's a subtle difference, but the Buddha said, give where you're inspired. And you're never in the red, not in this project. Like, we're fine. We have two huts. We usually have enough food. Ajahn Amaro's done the math, and it takes about as much to care for a monastic as it does to care for a Great Dane. a Great Dane. So, like, we're okay. And everything's just right as it is. There's no rush. Like, we're a little intimidated by the idea of getting a monastery. It took me 2 weeks to install a towel rack in my kitchen. Like, the idea of building a monastery is kind of terrifying. And it will happen. It's impossible and it's inevitable. And so I'd say if people just keep practicing and dedicate merit to us and to land and ask the Dhamma and the Devas and the angels to bring things together, and whatever you believe, I think there is something about intention which is meaningful. And just that would mean a lot right now, is if people every morning could dedicate their merit to, for the sake of all beings, being a servant of the Dhamma as much as they can. And if that means a place, a refuge of Dhamma manifesting in a monastery, then that would be really wonderful as a counterpoint to what Seattle Insight has already created in the urban contemplative space. Yeah. Would you supplement that at all?
Maybe just very small. I mean, we say we don't use any money, but then you might think, wait a minute, what about the basket? What about the basket out there? So we really don't touch money, don't use money. The Buddha did allow for monastics to have stewards, people who are not monks, who volunteer to look after funds that are given for monastics. So we have two 501c3s, one which is the monastic side of things, and that will be the owners of the eventual land. And then there's the Friends of Clear Mountain, which is a lay board who looks after any kind of liquid assets or funds. And they're the people who we're working with to work with the buying of this land. And it really is a long-term project. I mean, in Thai Buddhism, there's no lifetime vows. In Sri Lanka, in Nepal, it's really felt to be in China that you take vows as you do in Christian monasticism, and you're supposed to be a monastic for the rest of your life. And in Thailand, the actual norm is temporary ordination. People ordain for 3 months or 3 years or 1 month. Some people would do it for like a weekend. That's like, come on, guys. Come on.
Just a little bit longer.
Yeah, a little bit longer. But we both do aspire to be monks.
Ajahn Kovil is not allowed to disrobe.
Yeah, definitely not allowed to disrobe.
Self-imposed.
But,
that's right.
Yeah.
You can't. You don't want it, you can't. I'll go look for you.
Yeah, good. Please do. Accountability. Accountability. But yeah, this is a generational project. We do really survive off of very little, and we'll be happy in huts or in trailers. And then if we do get this land, that's fantastic. And if it takes, if it happens this year, great. If it happens 5 years from now, 10 years, if it takes, to build the size of a hall, we're thinking quite a big meditation, Dhamma gathering hall. And that'll take a while, but we're in it for generations. And hopefully the monastery will be there long after us. So
good. We appreciate it.
And I would just quickly say, like, what we're manifesting here is genuinely rare in the world, in the sense of having bhikkhunis, bhikkhus, lay men, lay women all together. There's only in the Theravada world, maybe one other place you see that manifest in a harmonious way, and that's Eastern Australia, Western Australia. So it's really special. We have bhikkhunis at Port Townsend in Olympia, at Canmore, over at Stravasti Abbey. It's really precious what's happening here, and this is part of that. So
great.
Robin
had her hand up.
So I just want to make a comment, just share a little bit, and then maybe ask a question, but I'm afraid of what the answer might be. So I don't know if I'll have the nerve to do that.
Can we bring the Zoom? Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you want to put it here?
They might not be able to hear the care of them.
Yeah, that would work. Yeah.
You want me to talk? Bring that to me. Okay. But I don't have to be on camera, right?
Okay. So my name is Robin, and I volunteered for Sims back in starting maybe 2014, posting their events on their website, but also on Northwest Dharma's website. And back then, somebody reached out to me and asked me, would I volunteer to try and get a Maya Mahasangha going with all these different sanghas around the Puget Sound region. And it didn't really go anywhere. There were several of us working on it, reaching out to people, and there just really wasn't much interest. I'm going to let the siren pass by before I continue. I have ADD, so sometimes it's hard for me to. Okay. So I was trying to reach out to different people, practitioners, leaders of sanghas all around the Puget Sound with other volunteers to try and get a Mahasangha going. And it really, after a year of a lot of effort and outreach, it didn't really go anywhere. And so I think the whole idea just kind of died in the water. I started out in Tibetan Buddhism and at Sakya Monastery in Seattle, and really had some difficulty connecting with other Sangha members, and there was cultural differences and language barriers and that sort of thing. And so I ended up not working with the Tulku that I was working with after a while, and came to Sims. Tori's been a great teacher to me personally. The song has been great. You know, when Sims moved to this place, it's too far for me, you know, but then when COVID hit and Tweri started offering her Sangha on Thursday nights on Zoom, I'd been wanting to go for a really long time. I don't live here in the city, so it's a ways for me to come. So then I have Tweri and she's been a great teacher. Then I started going to Steve Wilhelm's Sangha, East Side Meditation, also. And then Jason Bartlett's Luminous Dharma Sangha. So I go to a lot of different sanghas because I feel like I get something from each teacher in a different way. And at first, when I was with Tibetan Buddhism, was told that I needed to stick with one teacher, one lineage, and that sort of thing. But I really wasn't fulfilled. I wasn't getting what my needs met, I guess, spiritually. And so now here comes the monks. My husband came home one day and said there were two monks on the passenger only ferry today. And I said, what did they look like? What kind of robes were they wearing and all this? And then Steve Wilhelm mentioned in a sangha about you two and Clear Mountain. And so I just feel now, I see such an overlap here in all the sanghas that I attend, of people who come to all of them. And I feel like this Maha Sangha is happening with different maybe lineages and teachers and stuff, but really a sense of community, and getting different kinds of teachings and methods from different teachers has been really helpful for my practice and my path. So you know, everything that you three shared today was really powerful to me and meaningful. I just want to share one more personal thing if I can. My husband doesn't share this path with me, and he hasn't been interested. Really, I couldn't share much with him until he met Ajahn Nisabo. And I just want to thank you, because now I can have conversations with him. And when he talks about generosity, my husband has just become like very wants to practice generosity with you, with Clear Mountain. Thus, now it opened a door for me to talk about my path and my practice and have interest with my husband. So I'm super grateful for everybody here, all of my teachers.
Thank you.
I'm gonna check. We're gonna see if there's enough battery.
There you go.
Oh, never mind.
No, okay. Spoke for a lot of us.
You spoke fine. I agree. I think that's what Ajahn Nisabo is pointing to. This Maha Sangha, Maha meaning greater, this greater. And I think the Maha Sangha, with that, you know, bringing a monastery here, that's the way you would see it. So it's not the but it's all really lay still, regardless of whether or not you sat with that teacher or that teacher. But when you bring a monastery in, so our support to actually with the support of actually bringing a monastery in, that changes things.
There we go.
Can people hear us now?
Can you guys hear us?
Yep.
So did you happen to hear anything I just said?
It was great. It was really good.
You didn't hear none of it.
Well, you know, just to be quick, I was saying we're fortunate, what Ajahn Nisabo was saying, we're fortunate to have both lay practitioners and monastics together. And it's not just do you have a monastery or have monastics around and have lay practitioners. It's that we are in relationship with each other. And that's where the auspiciousness of this is. That's why we're doing this today. That's why we want to do more things like this, is so that this laity and the monastics, we are together in relationship. And that's what makes this auspicious.
Good.
Maybe just a little about the Maha Sangha. It's a beautiful phrase, the great gathering, the great assembly. And yeah, what Tawari said is really beautiful. And one other unique thing about the Dhamma in the West is that you've got all these different meetings of different traditions, like you're pointing to. You've got Tibetan Buddhism in America, in Thai Buddhism in America, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, Sri Lankan, Chinese, Vietnamese, Zen, Pure Land, all of these different things that come together, and we can learn from all of them. And one thing that we do at Clear Mountain, and I think to some degree here at Sims as well, is inviting different teachers to come and teach. So we have on our YouTube channel, we do interviews. We've done it with Thupten Chodron, Tibetan tradition, along with Jetsuma Tenzin Palmo, interviewed Tuere, interviewed Joseph Goldstein, interviewed Sharon Salzberg, interviewed lay people, interviewed monastics, Tibetan, Japanese, Chinese, all sorts of different traditions, and we can learn from all of them. So Maha in that sense. And also, yeah, we have interviewed and we plan to interview people who really are Maha in the the depth of sense. We get this breadth of practice, hearing all these different ways to practice, and we're all so different. We're all so different in what clicks and resonates and goes deep with. Some of us might not, it might just bounce off the surface. Whereas, yeah, hearing different teachings will resonate with us differently. And, yeah, we do, again, touching in on this belief, again, that yeah, there are enlightened, enlightenment is possible. There are transcendent mind states, and that there are people who've attained that. And, yeah, we have interviewed people who feel may have some level of attainment, some level of awakening, and just holding that possibility, or even just if you can't get your mind around that now, or it just seems like a trick, or you've never thought about it before, is it possible for a human to fully transcend greed, anger, and delusion? Maybe it's possible. And Maha, in that sense, is well, great, deep. So hopefully have that sangha as well, bring that sangha.
I can repeat your question too, unless you have it.
Thank you. I've really gotten a lot out of this nature. This is a little off the wall, I think, but I spent a day last week with my cousin from Utah. He's a devout Mormon. And as we were sitting, he was in here today running down these precepts, and I'm just checking the books. He's married, but you know, he's a person of deep faith, and he's also very human and warm, sharing. Where would the wider community of people of faith fit, relate to what we're talking about today?
Where would you like to speak first?
Oh, okay.
Sure, you want to speak first. I'll say something at the end.
Okay.
I think all people of faith find their way together. Someone asked me if I thought that a Christian or a Jewish person or Muslim or some other faith could be enlightened. And this is where I think we differ. I think we can all be proficient in our faith, whatever that faith is, and I think all faiths connect us all together to our humanness. But what I think the Buddha does differently is it is about us intentionally uprooting greed, hatred, and delusion from our minds. And that, I think, is the Satipatthana. So that's where I think we're different. Aside from that, I think we all relate to each other, of people of faith, in a very common way.
That's a great answer. And there's a Venerable Sariputta compares the Buddha's teaching to an elephant's footprint, where he says it's the largest footprint, but all the other footprints of the other animals before fit inside it. And I think that's a good simile. You know, some other religions, they're a bit smaller in scope, but they fit inside. Some are a little on the edge. They miss this or that. You know, in Christianity, there's not actually anything against killing animals. You know, they get it right in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, Dostoevsky and Nietzsche's great insight, I think, was there's this enlightenment conceit that you get rid of all the superstitious religion and people become completely reasonable. But what actually happens is people become so unreasonable so quickly it boggles the mind. And there's something in us which I really think needs a religious substructure in the sense of, you know, something in us knows we're meant for more than a well-adjusted middle-class life. Something in us knows we need some purpose that sustains against the tragedy, which is a human rebirth. There's a lot of difficulty and loss. And religious frameworks provide that. And if that need is not fulfilled, I think a lot of the culture wars of the current moment in the U.S. can be laid at the feet of this lacking structure and people therefore projected onto ideology. And ideologies are like crippled religions. They limp along
and provides some measure of cohesion and purpose, but it's shallow and lacks all the richness and subtlety. So what Buddhism does, which is so beautiful, is it provides a palatable, unbelievably wise framework. And so we don't have to wade into a lot of things. We can give people that. And we can honor it in others, because I think, like when the Dalai Lama was asked what religion is best, he said, yours.
Yeah.
And Buddhism is the most comprehensive, because it is.
We're not biased.
We're not biased, but we're biased with some serious background. And it's true. I stand by that one, but it is a particular answer. But I'd say we have Christian monks that live by us at Abhayagiri, and we resonate so deeply with them. And not trying to convert people, just connecting on the deeper strata of religious faith is so deep. And one of my main meditation words is God. You know, like, I think there's huge realm here to invoke those words and concepts and grace. The book The Way of the Pilgrim, or Thomas Keating's Intimacy with God, are really good ways to bridge the Christian-Buddhist divide, and I think significant. So,
yeah, Living Buddha, Living Christ.
Living Buddha, Living Christ by Thich Nhat Hanh. We just did a shared Tezay service faith with St. Mark's Cathedral last month, where they sang Christian hymns and we chanted Buddhist chants. And theirs were a lot prettier, I have to say.
Yeah, they're pretty. That's great. Okay, one more with Susan. Then you want to make any comments?
I wanted to share when Rodney was our founding teacher, and he was my main teacher. And I would go in for my interviews, and he always asked me, "How's your sitting practice?" And I'd say back then, "So-so." "How's your living practice?" And he always encouraged me to bring what I understood of the Dhamma to my work, to the employees I had, to how I relationships and stuff. And that has stayed with me so long that it seems like we lay people have a role of bringing the Dhamma with us every single place we go, everyone we talk to, everything we do. When I started practicing seriously, I became such a better boss. Oh my goodness, partly because I think I started to have some humility in that. And it seems like there's such a role for lay folks to translate Buddhist language into just ordinary conversational stuff that I wanted to share that, because I am really happy to be part of both a lay community and a monastic-led community. And we've got our work to do. And of course, we can't do that out there if we don't have a sitting practice. Mine has gotten better over the years, but I would love to hear any comments about taking the Dhamma with us.
Maybe we could fit that into just closing comments with
okay.
The three of us.
Okay, I'll start. Okay.
I think everything we teach, I think the Dhamma itself is a living practice. It's a verb. Even though we say it, we talk in nouns in English, but it's a verb. So everything about Dhamma is to be lived through, and the wisdom of that is to be lived through. So everything we teach here at Seattle Insight is to be lived into. In some way or another, we are to see the wisdom of whatever we're teaching in our ordinary lives, in like you say, as a boss, or just as a person walking down the street or going into a grocery store. Can we see what we're learning in our ordinary lives? And I think when we do, what the Buddha said was, you know, if you see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha. If you see the Buddha, you see the Dhamma. So if we begin to see what we are, you know, exploring each year, each teaching, each session, what we're exploring, if we begin to see it in our lives, we'll see the Buddha. And if we see the Buddha, we'll see the Dhamma.
Yes, Suze, you're totally right. I mean, in the West, we fetishize the posture of meditation, and we just think that that's the essence of what a Buddhist or a spiritual practice is, and leave it at that. Okay, it's just the 15 minutes or the half an hour that we do. And we forget that, as Tawari was saying, Buddhism is all about verbs, about action. We do talk about karma, but the root of the word karma and the actual meaning of karma is to act. Karma is action from the verb to act, to just be in the world. We're creating karma all the time, whether you're a monastic, whether you're a layperson, whatever your vows are, we're acting all the time. We can't just, even if we don't acknowledge that, still we're living in the world. We have to live the Dhamma, as you're saying. And as monastics, we have this constant visual, tactile reminder that we're living within these rules. And for all of you who aren't monastics or aren't wearing kind of a Buddhist costume, you know, you have to figure out other ways to really remember, because that's what we do as humans, is we just forget our highest goals because we look around and not everybody is living them the way that we want to. So finding other ways, finding the structures, whether it's your friend groups or your daily routine or whatever apps you have on your phone or the different websites you visit, instantiating your Buddhist practice, instantiating your life, finding ways to tap into your highest beliefs and living those, living your virtue, living your generosity, your aspirations to really live a life of peace, not anger. So you all have to figure out how to do that. And as you're saying, as lay teachers, honestly, in some ways you have a harder job, because if you really want to do, if you want to live this urban mendicant or urban renunciate, contemplative role, it's a fascinating term. And really, this is just like the first or second generation that's trying to figure out what that looks like in America. You're at the vanguard. Yeah. So you have to bring sincerity to that and create your own structures. So yeah, wish you all the best. And we're all grateful because it's inspiring whichever way the inspiration flows. So just honoring the wisdom of Tway. And you really, with all these interviews we've done, we've really noticed the difference with people who, there's some teachers where you just see this profound respect for the Dhamma, just this deep veneration and just complete lack of kind of that conceit. And Tway, we're always moved by that relationship with you, really. And Suze, likewise, to see just your coming and then the joy and warmth you bring to the teaching, Tway, it's very needed. And Ajahn, you too. One of just the biggest blessing of the last year has been Ajahn Kawilo, my brother, and we've read a marriage book since then, and we're super.
You know all about it.
Zen-in-laws. Zen-in-laws. Not great at hugs yet. I used to be really good.
Yeah.
Okay. But I do think that one thing, there's this great sutta called Uga, the Uga Sutta, and this speaks to some of the other points you're bringing up, Suze. U-G-G-A, it's worth looking up. And the Blessed One says, Uga the householder has 8 marvelous and wonderful qualities. And then he leaves. And then the monks are like, okay. So they go to Uga and they say, what are the 8 wonderful and marvelous qualities you have, Uga? And Uga says, I do not know what the Blessed One is talking about exactly, but I do have these 8 marvelous and wonderful qualities. And then he goes on to say, this isn't conceit though. Okay, so he says, first, when I was cavorting in the park, I saw the Blessed One. This is the first, and went to him and heard a teaching. The second quality is, when I went and listened to the teaching, my drunkenness disappeared. So he was drunk. And the Buddha gave me a gradual discourse, and the Dharma eye arose in me, and I saw the Dhamma stream entering. The third is that when that happened, I undertook the 5 precepts with the 5th as celibacy, and gave my wives, pulling in this, permission to leave me, and gave them all my wealth and said, you can go live on your own or go back to your families, whatever you want. And as they left, I felt not the slightest wavering in my heart. So he releases his wives from this kind of commitment. Fourth is, I often, when monastics come and I give them food, devas and deities will come to me and say, this venerable one is liberated through wisdom, this venerable one is liberated through faith. But despite knowing the different liberations of each monastic, I give the exact same amount of food to every single one. So cool. The next is, often deities will come to me and say, the Dharma is well expounded by the Blessed One, apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation. And I say, thank you, but I do not need you to say, the Dharma is well expounded by the Blessed One. I know the Dharma is well expounded by the Blessed One. This is another marvelous and wonderful quality of Ugga. And there's like two more, and I've forgotten them. But what it's such a brilliant sutta. It's such a hidden gem. First he's drunk at first. He's cavorting in the park. And weren't we all when the Dharma found us in one way or the other? And then the Dharma sobers him up. He intuits something about this monastic, and he approaches him. And the Dharma touches him, and he becomes solid. And his Dharma eye opens, and he sees something true. And then this third quality where he releases those he loves in freedom. And that's this difference where once we gain this internal sense of stability and peace, we no longer have to feed off those we love. We can still be a husband or a wife or a boss, but we have something to give, and it's a liberative love rather than a feeding love. And that's a profound shift. And then this relationship, and then he says, when I attend on a monastic, either I do so respectfully, and either they teach me the Dhamma or I teach them the Dhamma. And this is Chitta and Ugga and others, like, they teach monastics the Dhamma. And it's this acknowledgement of there's this openness and this back and forth communion with the lay community. We're not monastic supremacists. We like people ordaining. Tweri, if you ever feel like shit in your head, I'll help you. But just this interchange. And the other one, marvelous qualities, he's an anagami. He's a non-returner. He's attained the third stage of enlightenment. And just the final one where he knows for himself the power of the Dhamma. And it's just such a beautiful model for how far the lay form can take one and what this can do to us. And I just think it's a sutta worth keeping in mind, for we each find ourselves in these different forms, but we're stewarding something profound and deep into being right now at this key moment in the history of the West. And it's something we have to do together. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much.
What should we do now, Tori?
We probably could sit just a little bit before we go.
I got it, guided. Sit for the last few minutes.
Yeah.
Body upright. And bring up the sense of mudita or joy. That arises when you think of your teachers. And of your companions on this path sitting around you. And say, I'm so grateful and have this sense of uplift and lightening in the heart. Now just imagine holding your hands in Anjali and having that teacher wrap their hands around yours, gazing at you with deep compassion. And hold that pose. Your hands in Anjali, wrapped in the warm hands of the teacher who keeps and holds you in that posture, gazing into your eyes. Now imagine that that teacher gently presses your palms to your heart. And imagine a pearl underneath those palms in the heart. The potential for awakening that your teacher sees in you. Don't just stay with the image, actually feel it. Feel that pearl in your heart. Your potential for awakening. Keep it with you as you go about your day, your year, and your month. I'll finish just with the Mary Oliver poem, which I always love. One day you finally knew what you had to do. And began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, and the wind pried with its fingers the very foundations of the house. You didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though their melancholy was terrible. Mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. It was already late,
and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But slowly, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and you heard a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, keeping you company as you strove deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. You all be well.
Appreciate you being online. I know it was difficult. We all really, really appreciate your sincerity and the depth of your practice to stay through all that difficulty. So Seattle Insight, if you ever want to come and sit with us, we always meet on Monday nights here in person and online. And we have various little sanghas that depending on your day and time about where you could come and sit with us online with different meeting times. I want to thank Sean for coming here, and I want to personally thank Sean for her work in getting the request for the refuges and precepts. It was quite beautiful. Yeah, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It was very nice. And I think that's it. So I'll let you guys do the last blessing. I just want to share whatever merit we joined here, whatever merit we created here, may we share it with all beings everywhere so that all beings can know suffering and the end of suffering.
Actually, can we bring to mind names for towards the invocation of sharing? You'd like to share with Bill, who I believe passed away this afternoon, quite possibly. Others, just say the names if there's someone on your mind or heart.
Angela Wasser died on July 2nd.
Angela, who passed away on July 2nd.
Jason.
Charlotte, whose mother died.
Mike.
Max.
Big Taggart.
Max and Big Taggart?
Rick
Taggart. Vic Taggart. Sorry. Vic Taggart.
Oh, Vic Taggart.
Yes.
Too bad.
And to Twere, to Sims, to this whole community, and to the Dharma continuing to spread here in the Northwest.
Thank you.
Chant a traditional Pali verse.
Sabitiyo vivacanto sabaroga vinasatu vate bhavat vantarayo sukhiti kayuko bhavabhivadana sili sanicha udapachayino chataro dhamma vadanti ayuvano sukham phalam.
Thank you.
It's very nice. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate you.
Sean,
hope I see
Cheryl.
You again.
Yeah.
All right. Got a little saying goodbye. Sparkle fingers.
Cheryl, thank you.
Bye-bye, thank you. Oh, yes, I forgot Cheryl. You really were on it today. Thank you.